Well, good evening, and thank you, everyone, for joining us tonight. Thank you to the criminal law section for giving us an opportunity. Thank you to my opponent for being here. My name is Raul Torres. I am a product of this community, and I think, like so many of you, I have real concerns about our criminal justice system, about allegations of unconstitutional policing, about the state of public safety, and fundamentally about a system that seems broken beyond repair. I have handled some of the toughest cases as both a state and federal prosecutor, murder cases, sexual assault, child abuse, and I know that there is a real urgency when dealing with violent crime, but it's not enough, I think, to just be tough on crime. We have to start being smart on crime. We have to adopt new policies and new approaches and data-driven ideas to reform this system, and I look forward to explaining those ideas to you throughout the evening.
I'm Ed Perea, and I want to be your district attorney. The district attorney is the chief law enforcement officer of this county. I'm a prosecutor. I believe in law and order. I'm the son of a former police officer and a homemaker, and I'm a parent. I believe that our community, we all deserve to be safe in our community. I believe we all need to be held accountable. But we are a community in crisis. We are a community with rising crime rates, rising property crimes, rising violent crime rates, and we no longer trust some of our criminal justice agencies that are called upon to protect us. This race is about integrity, about leadership, and about community. I've spent over the last three decades being part of this community, and I'm the only candidate who has extensive law enforcement experience. And I look forward to talking to you about that, those qualifications.
The Albuquerque Police Department is in the midst of a reform process under an agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice after federal investigators found that officers demonstrated a pattern of violating the Constitution and using excessive force. If elected, you would have to work closely with APD. Mr. Torres, how will your office decide whether to prosecute or not to prosecute officers if they break the rules, if they injure or kill people?
Well, first, I think it's important for people to understand that when you apply a different set of rules to police officers and allegations of officer misconduct, you erode faith and confidence in the institutions of justice. So the answer is actually quite simple. We evaluate those cases the same way we evaluate cases involving any allegations against any other individual who may have committed a crime. We look at the strength of the evidence. We look at whether or not we can meet our burden in the court of law. And if we find that there is enough evidence to move forward, we absolutely have an obligation to do that. But there's another sort of component to this, which I think is fundamentally important. We have to move away from this process of secretive investigative grand juries, where we show up and we don't bring a charging document to the grand jury. If we're going to make a decision about whether to prosecute an officer, we ought to have the courage to stand in front of this community and either explain, no, I can't meet my burden, I don't think there was a violation of the law, and I am going to decline to prosecute that officer, or I think there is sufficient evidence to move forward, in which case I think we should go by way of preliminary hearing. The community needs to have an opportunity to weigh all the evidence because of the specific special circumstances involved in officer misconduct. I think we have done that finally correctly in the Boyd case, and I think that's the right way to go.
As I mentioned in my opening statement, we are all held accountable. No one is above the law. As a career crime fighter, I realize the obligation of serving the community. We need to ensure that our law enforcement officers are held to the higher standard. And we need to ensure that if police officers break the law, that they are held accountable. But we must ensure balance and we must ensure fairness. What my office will do, and will immediately do, is initiate a special prosecutor model approach to all police shootings. I'm currently a special prosecutor. Many of the cases I've been assigned are cases involving law enforcement officers. I've been assigned those cases because of my expertise in law enforcement matters. And I will reach out as your district attorney and identify those experts who I could bring on board to serve as a special prosecutor. What a special prosecutor will do, it's independent of the office. We want no appearance of impropriety. We want to ensure that we have the public trust. The DA's office, our entire criminal justice system, relies on public trust. And the special prosecutor will allow that to occur.
Mr. Torres, is a special prosecutor model the kind of thing that you're thinking of when you're talking about how to determine whether to prosecute police officers?
Well, I think it's important that we move away from prosecutions that are directed by district attorney's offices that work day-to-day with law enforcement agencies. Unfortunately, the special prosecutor model has some funding issues that go along with that. You're going to have to find funding to pay for those prosecutors, and with the volume of officer misconduct cases that we've got, I think there's going to be some issues there. There's an existing unit. I worked in the unit. The Special Prosecutions Division of the Attorney General's Office is well-equipped to handle those types of cases, and they have enough distance, I think, from the day-to-day operations of law enforcement agencies around the state. I think that would be a good model. I also think that we could set up a blind panel of a rotating conflict panel of DAs from around the state so that we would never be in the position of evaluating claims of misconduct from our own jurisdiction. But I don't think that an ad hoc special prosecutor model is sustainable over the long run from a fiscal standpoint.
Follow-up question for you. Since I asked Mr. Torres about your proposal, I'll ask you about Mr. Torres' proposal about DAs taking turns playing that role for other districts in the state. Is that something? What's your response to that?
That also is an option. There are multiple options out there. And, of course, as district attorney, we would consider all options. I personally like the special prosecutor model because I function under that model and I see the fairness. I see how it works. However, that wouldn't preclude me from looking at other options because I think it's important that we interact closely with other district attorney's offices from around the state and make sure that we are working together. And I think that that's very much a viable option in my book. You know, I won't close the door to any possible option that will work. But this special prosecutor model is about priorities. This is such an important issue in our community that we need to approach it in innovative ways. And the special prosecutor model is something that works.
I'm going to deviate from my rules briefly to ask a question, which is yes or no question. It sounds like you're both saying the district attorney's office in Bernalillo County should not be the only entity deciding whether or not to prosecute police officers. Sounds like you're both saying that.
That's correct.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to another question. What you both mentioned the relationship between the Albuquerque Police Department and the district attorney's office. Mr. Padilla, what do you want the DA's relationship with APD to look like? Does that relationship need strengthening, or does the office need to have more distance from law enforcement?
Strengthening the relationship is probably one of the most important things that we can do to ensure the public trust. Law enforcement, the DA's office, the courts and the corrections, probation and parole, we're all on the same team. We all share the same mission, and that's to ensure that we protect the citizens of Bernalillo County. It's important that we work closely with all the agencies. We must ensure that we communicate with every agency and keep lines of communication open. We must ensure that we collaborate and that we're working together. And we must make sure that we cooperate because it's about the community. It's about the public. My number one priority, because I've served for nearly a quarter of a century as a law enforcement officer and work closely with the DA's office, work closely with the courts, and I know how important that relationship is in order to move our community forward.
Mr. Torres, same question. What do you want the DA's relationship to look like, the relationship with APD to look like? Does that relationship need strengthening, or does that relationship need more distance?
Well, I think it's actually both. You know, we're in a situation now where we have a fractured relationship between the Albuquerque Police Department and the District Attorney's Office for historical reasons, for structural reasons. We have a lot of work to do repairing relationships with frontline prosecutors, with leadership in both of those agencies. I take a slightly different position than my opponent, though. I think the District Attorney's Office has an important role that is, frankly, separate and apart from the DA, from the Police Department. We need to be an internal check, a point of reference for what are appropriate legal standards, constitutional standards. We need to be a place where we can help officers develop constitutionally sound cases and investigations. And that oftentimes involves declining cases up front. When we know as prosecutors we have an obligation, if there's been a violation of someone's constitutional rights, we have an obligation to bring that to the attention of officers and have the strength and the courage and conviction to decline those cases. But we also have an obligation to public safety to not stop there and say, listen, this is why we've declined this case. We've violated some constitutional provision. But now I'm going to help you. Now I'm going to work with you so that the next time you bring a case to me or the next time you're interacting with a member of the public, you know what the constitutional limitations are. So we have to have a stronger relationship, but we have to use some of our judgment and wisdom to guide, I think, a brighter path for the police department.
Jails in Bernalillo County, mainly the Metropolitan Detention Center, we're seeing more and more people being incarcerated who have untreated mental health conditions or substance abuse issues. There aren't enough treatment centers for these folks. And the Bernalillo County Metropolitan Detention Center has been called the largest mental health care provider in the state of New Mexico, the jail itself. Raul Torres, how will your office handle nonviolent drug offenses?
So this is a core component of my campaign. I have been advocating for the establishment of what's called the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, which got off the ground in Seattle. It's currently being studied in Santa Fe, and they're having real success with that program. And what it does is it allows frontline officers to take someone who is a nonviolent offender, they don't pose a risk, and don't have a history of violence in the community. If they have chronic addiction, rather than taking them to jail, we can take them directly to a treatment provider to provide wraparound services, to give them counseling, to give them help, to hopefully reduce the harm that they cause to themselves and to others. And the most important feature of this program, at least based on the findings in Seattle, is they found that there's been a 67% reduction in recidivism for people that they take directly to treatment rather than the people that we take to jail. We've got to start recognizing that jail is not the place for the chronically addicted and the mentally ill. We've done this for far too long in this country. We spend $90 billion a year incarcerating more people than any other country on the planet, and it has to stop. Now, I recognize that we need to get tough with violent offenders and people that have guns and people that abuse children, but we have to stop locking up people that have addiction issues and mental health issues, and I'm prepared to make that a core part of my administration and district attorney's office.
Mr. Perea, same question. How will your office handle nonviolent drug offenses?
We are a community in crisis, as I mentioned earlier. 70%, it's estimated that 70% of the inmates at the Metropolitan Detention Center have some sort of mental health or drug issue. We're spending about $55,000 a year to incarcerate an individual. My model that I've created, it's a local model based upon 3 decades of experience, is called the Comprehensive Community Public Safety and Prosecution Initiative. And that what that will do is that will allow us to reach out and create partnerships, as I mentioned, with all the criminal justice agencies and other stakeholders. So when we have individuals who come forward who clearly have either a drug problem, a mental health problem, or even a low-level drug use issue, they will immediately go to a diversion route. Because diversion is the most effective way with first-time minor drug offenders. It's about prevention, intervention, and treatment. If we can prevent up front, we save taxpayers and possible victims in the future a whole lot of costs and grief in their lives. If we intervene, we are able, again, to save enforcement and prosecution costs. It's much cheaper to prevent and intervene, and that's what will work best, and that's what's worked best for our community, and we'll do more of it in the future.
Mr. Perea, what role will drug and DUI courts play if you are elected? Will you encourage or mandate that your attorneys support and grow these kinds of interventions before or after conviction?
Prevention is the key. Alcohol abuse is a real problem and a real issue in our community. We have a 47% or so dismissal rate of DWIs in our community. The fatality rate involving drunk drivers continues to remain high. We need to do something about this problem. As a police officer, I handled many fatal accidents involving drunk drivers. And I can still picture the bodies and the carnage in my mind. I know how that important that is to our community. And I've seen the pain of the family members who were left behind. We need to treat this issue up front. We need to take a proactive role with anyone who enters the criminal justice system and has some sort of addiction or alcohol-related issue. It's about prevention and intervention.
Mr. Torres, same question. What role will drug and DUI courts play for your office if you are elected? Will you encourage or mandate attorneys in the office to support and grow these kinds of interventions before or after conviction?
Well, I think we need to do everything that we can to move diversion as far forward in the process as we possibly can. One of the reasons I actually prefer the LEAD model is that it allows people to be diverted from the criminal justice system prior to booking. And one of the reasons that that's so important is once you put someone in the criminal justice system, if they're a nonviolent offender, once they have that record on, you know, once that follows them, that booking record follows them, it impacts their ability to get housing. It impacts their ability to get services. It impacts their ability to get a job. So we have to start looking at harm reduction models, because a lot of times it's going to take several attempts for people to get themselves off drugs and get themselves the kind of treatment and therapy that they need. And we have to recognize that spending money on those things is truly about public safety. It's about saving people's lives. It's about saving this community money. But what it really comes down to is a reorientation in the way we think. We're having a discussion in Santa Fe right now about cutting Medicaid reimbursement. We're living through a moment in time where we have demolished mental health services across the state and across this county. And those are public safety issues. Those are public safety issues as much as anything else that we discuss. And we start. And DAs need to have a voice at the table when those things are under consideration.
Follow-up question for each of you. You'll have 45 seconds. Explain what you mean specifically about a proactive role about early intervention. I want to know exactly what you would do specifically to implement the kind of overhaul of these approaches that you're talking about. Mr. Torres first, and then we'll come back to you, Mr. Perea.
Well, the first thing that we need to do is we need to start rebuilding the capacity for mental health services and drug treatment services in this community. And I know that there are budgetary pressures in Santa Fe, but there are national organizations. In Seattle, what they did is they got a grant from the Ford Foundation to kick off new treatment providers in the community so that if we're going to divert a meaningful percentage of the population, we actually have some place to go. The district attorney needs to be part of a grant application to national philanthropic organizations. If we can't go to Santa Fe and find the money, we need to go to D.C. and find money under the Affordable Care Act or through national foundations.
It's about prioritization. Years ago, we had a facility, a grant-funded facility. It was a detox center. And what that allowed is for police officers, upon initial contact with individuals who may have been intoxicated, instead of taking them to jail and incarcerating them for public intoxication, they went to a detox center and they were treated. And we've realized the number of calls for service by law enforcement and the number of actions by intoxicated individuals that took up and cost the community a lot of money over the course of the years. So we would immediately go to a detox model approach that was effective in the past in order to reduce the number of cases involving those who are intoxicated.
Governor Susana Martinez announced in April that the state will pay staffers with the group Mothers Against Drunk Driving to observe judges looking for routine leniency in DUI cases. The information about the sentences and the judges will then be distributed on Twitter. Mr. Perea, is this an effective way to ensure that drunk drivers don't get off too easy? What do you think of this approach?
That is so important, and we need to do more of it. And this is a throwback. Some of you may have heard this concept. It's called community-oriented policing. And this is one of the basic principles of community-oriented policing, is that we create partnerships with the public. And what is done as one of the component parts of community-oriented policing is we establish court monitors. We get everyday citizens or individuals who've been affected by drunk drivers or are concerned about this issue, and they go in and they observe the sentencing phases. I understand how important it is. As I mentioned, I investigated fatal accidents involving drunk drivers. I myself was a victim of a drunk driver, and I've arrested countless of drunk drivers over the years. And so I realized the importance of addressing this issue aggressively and head-on.
Mr. Torres, this new initiative that the governor has announced, is it an effective strategy to ensure that drunk drivers don't get off easy? What do you think of the approach?
You know, I have all the respect in the world for folks that have lost a loved one to drunk driving. However, I don't agree that we should be spending taxpayer money funding another organization to sit in a courtroom and attempt to influence politically the conclusions reached by judges. We go through an extensive vetting process for judges. We rely on them and their discretion to interpret and follow the law. And we, as the public, have a responsibility to hold people accountable, including the judiciary. But the governor and the administration should not be in the business of trying to influence the outcomes of individual cases. It's not an appropriate use of that kind of money. I have every respect, like I said, for those organizations and look forward to working with them about how we can more effectively present our cases, about how we can do a better job at not having such a high dismissal rate, about how we can turn over discovery in a timely fashion. But we shouldn't be attempting to bully judges in the courtroom.
This is one of those questions where my opponent and I are clearly at odds. I believe so strongly because I've seen this work. People who have been victimized by drunk drivers or their families have been victimized and they themselves are victims want to be part of this process. And it's important as part of our accountability component that we have those members of MAD or other concerned citizens out there to sit in the courtroom and let the judges know that there are people whose lives have been affected and people who care. And I think most judges are very good about this. Most judges understand the devastation that drunk driving can cause to a family or to an individual. But sometimes getting the public involved serves as a reminder that it's important to our community in order to reduce drunk driving.
As I said before, every respect for victims and advocacy groups who stand up for victims. They absolutely have a voice, and they absolutely should be part of the process. But I think a more constructive way to have MAD involved is to invite them to participate and give us feedback in the district attorney's office about how we can do a better job of putting these cases together. Because at the end of the day, that's what we need to do. We need MAD to help us advocate for more resources, for more officers on the street, for more training, for more resources and better salaries for starting prosecutors. And I think we can be better served by their advocacy in that context, and I would invite them to participate in my administration by giving that type of feedback.
Follow-up question for you both. We do hear about cases where folks who've been convicted of DUI 9, 10, 14 times, right? So follow-up question, Mr. Torres first. How will you prioritize locking up people who drive under the influence in these kind of repeat fashions, and what will your approach be to these kinds of cases?
Well, one of the things that I think we need to do is really elevate the status of these types of offenders within our system. We need to fundamentally reorient the district attorney's office around violent crime and around people who pose the greatest threat to our society, and I would think repeat violent offenders, DUI offenders, fit into that category. And that means we need to start assigning more senior prosecutors to those types of cases more paralegal and support staff to those types of cases so that we can get the discovery done and make sure that they are on par with all of the rest of violent crimes in the community. We haven't done that, but we should.
Mr. Perea, same question. When we're talking about repeat DUI offenders, how will you prioritize locking up folks who drive under the influence? What will your approach be to these types of cases?
Part of my reorganization of the DA's office will include a repeat offender trial team. Whenever we have repeat offenders, depending on the severity of the time, we're going to use experienced prosecutors in order to focus in on those repeat offenders. We're focusing a lot, clearly, on the violent offenders, because violent offenders create the most destruction to our community, but DWIs can also create the same destruction and death to innocent lives in our community. I would use this repeat offender team, trial team, in order to ensure that we are aggressively prosecuting those who haven't learned the lesson. By 9 or 10 DWIs, there's really a problem there, and we need to aggressively prosecute those people. Again, it's all about prevention and intervention, but at some point, we need to aggressively prosecute.
Thank you. Let's talk about the kinds of priorities you would set for your office were you to be elected. Mr. Perea, is the district attorney's office over or under indicting cases right now, and why do you think that?
Indictments between 2014 and 2015 are probably down 60%. And a lot of that is as a result of the new rule, local rule 2400. If cases need to be indicted, and we need to ensure that we're focusing, and again, it's all about prioritizing, we need to look at those cases involving violent criminals. And we can't let those cases slip through the cracks. We need to ensure that if someone commits a violent act in our community, that they are indicted. But we have to work with law enforcement. We need to ensure, as a result of the local rule, we need to ensure that the prosecutors in the DA's office has the information that they need to indict. There may be some minor offenses that we may have indicted in the past, that using this model that I've talked about, a diversion model, maybe we don't need to indict those. So those lower-level crime indictments may not be the problem. The problem lies with those failure to indict violent offenders, and that's my biggest concern. Going back to my repeat offender trial team, it would be important that we aggressively prosecute and indict the most violent offenders in our community to ensure public safety.
Thank you. Mr. Torres, is the district attorney's office over or under indicting cases right now, and why do you think that?
Well, I think there's obviously been a decline in the number of indictments since the implementation of the new rule. And I think that that's a result of the sort of the clear understanding on the part of the Supreme Court that we had a real problem in Bernalillo County for a long time. We were over-indicting cases. We were presenting cases that we couldn't present in a reasonable amount of time. Defendants were stacking up in MDC, and we couldn't bring resolution to those issues. And so the Supreme Court forced a solution, quite frankly, by implementing these new rules. Now, the real question is, do we have the resources to meet the obligations imposed by the new rules? I think the initial answer is no. But fortunately, the Supreme Court has already shown a willingness to adjust those rules and provide people with operating within the system extended time, and I'm confident that they're going to provide new resources in the future for us and maybe new timelines in the future so that we can meet the new obligations. We're obviously not getting the job done with repeat violent offenders, but frankly, that has more to do with the fact that we don't communicate. No one in this community can give you a definitive list of the 250 or 500 most dangerous, most violent offenders based on some objective metric. They can in New York, they can in San Francisco, they can in other communities around this country, because they use a unified data-based and data-driven approach that uses analytics to analyze every single offender that comes through a system. We need to start modernizing what we do in Bernalillo County, and that would make a big, big impact.
Follow-up question, 45 seconds each. If you are elected, will you be pushing back against these new rules? They're known as the case management order. Will you be pushing back against them if you are elected, and what would you change, Mr. Torres?
So I think the first step that we need to do is we have an obligation as actors within the institution to do everything we can do within the four corners of our office to make sure we're aligned properly, that we have all the efficiency and productivity that we can get out of our office. If we get to that point where we've made all of those changes internally in how we manage and analyze and prioritize cases, and we still aren't able to meet the obligations and officers still aren't able to bring those cases in a timely way, I will absolutely engage with the Supreme Court and say, we need to alter these things. But these rules are not set in stone. I spent 3 years on the Rules Committee for the Supreme Court, and they have demonstrated a willingness to change in the past, and I think they will again in the future. But first, they're going to expect us to make significant changes on our own.
Mr. Perea, will you be pushing back against these new rules? If you are elected, what would you change?
Local Rule 2400, time has come. It's such an important rule to our community, and it's such an important rule to ensure sure and swift punishment. It's an important rule to ensure that due process is provided at the earliest possibility. We have had individuals who've been arrested for shoplifting who are locked away for 6 months. We can't allow that to happen. There's a reason why we have the rule, and the rule is to ensure that we expedite the process so that citizens have the opportunity for a speedy trial and have the opportunity for due process. The rule is important, and my office will ensure that we engage in efficiency so we could comply with the rule accordingly.
New question, 90 seconds. Mr. Perea, a measure that would prevent some nonviolent defendants from being stuck in jail just because they can't pay bail will go before voters in November. Will you vote for this constitutional amendment? Why or why not?
This is one of those constitutional amendments that really got the public's attention. Got the public's attention as a result of the current rule, which pretty much requires judges to take certain actions and not allow judges to hold violent offenders. But also in addition to that, there were individuals who were incarcerated for minor offenses because they couldn't afford bail. And I think it's so important under our Eighth Amendment to the Constitution that we are allowed, as the situation arises and under certain circumstances, to be afforded the opportunity for bail. And it's especially important for those who can't afford bail and have minor offenses that they be allowed to be released without the use of bail. I would vote for that constitutional amendment.
Thank you. Mr. Torres, same question. The measure that will go before voters in November, making it so that some nonviolent defendants won't be stuck in jail if they can't pay bail. Will you vote for it? Why or why not?
Yes, I think this is an important step in terms of accomplishing two important goals. The first is part of the amendment allows that certain violent offenders can be held without bail based on certain judicial findings. If a court finds that someone presents too much of a danger to the community or as a flight risk, we now have an opportunity rather than the old system where we set bail at an extraordinarily high level. Judges can go through a process where they can detain violent offenders. I think judges need that tool, and it's long past time that we give them that. At the same time, we shouldn't be holding people in jail who are nonviolent simply because they are too poor to pay bail. That doesn't make sense. It costs lots of money, and it's not in keeping with our values. So I think it's an important measure.
Next question. Black, African-American people, Native Americans, Hispanic, Latino folks make up a disproportionate portion of the jail population, according to a UNM study from 2013. Mr. Torres, what would you do as district attorney to ensure that the justice system does not discriminate?
Well, I think one of the important things, again, is to implement a new screening process and a new training process for all prosecutors, not just new prosecutors. And what I mean by that is simply this, and I think people who work in the system can appreciate it. A lot of times, you can have the same defendant or two defendants facing the same charge, and depending on which prosecutor's desk they end up on, one might get a plea agreement, one might get a full ride to a trial. and no leniency. We need to do more to use data at the outset to actually empirically rank these offenders without any consideration of their ethnic background or race or anything. We need to strip away all of those things and just look at people based on the evidence, the strength of the evidence. And if we can do that and allow people to be guided by an empirical, objective measurement, my hope is we can reduce a lot of this, what I think is probably unconscious bias on the part of people that are in law enforcement, because it's true that those folks play or constitute a higher percentage of the population, but it goes beyond that. You know, the district attorney's office has a role to get out in the community and work in low-income neighborhoods with at-risk youth to try and head these things off before they end up in the criminal justice system. That's as much a part of our mandate as anything we do on punishment.
Thank you, Mr. Torres. Mr. Perea, what would you do to ensure that our justice system does not discriminate?
I look at that as a travesty. When we have members of minority groups in our community that are being incarcerated at a much higher rate, and often for those offenses that wouldn't normally require incarceration. We're incarcerating for very minor offenses, and often those offenses that are based upon basic needs. Shoplifting, for example. I've handled a number of shoplifting over the years from people who just wanted a meal. I've handled offenses over the years from individuals who were just trying to get by. For those very minor offenses, I think we really need to look at our diversion model. And whenever we screen these cases, because that's going to be a priority, is that we screen these cases and identify those cases that need to be prosecuted and those cases that need to be diverted. We need to strengthen our diversion of the most minor cases, because often that's where we find members of minority groups caught up in the criminal justice system. We need to do a better job at screening those cases out. So we give those minority groups, members of minority groups, the opportunity.
Thank you. New question, 90 seconds. Mr. Perea, how would your office approach determining whether to prosecute domestic violence cases?
And again, being a career crime fighter, I've been dispatched to probably literally hundreds of domestic violence cases. I've dealt with domestic violence victims. And I've seen the pain in their eyes. And I understand the cycle of violence. But it's a very unique sort of crime that we prosecute. There are a lot of dynamics involved. There are some that are very clearly we need to be hard on the offender. But there are others that we look at, we have to look at the circumstances, and we have to use common sense. But we need trained prosecutors to ensure that we're making the right decisions, that we're not just cookie-cuttering all our prosecutions, that we take a look at the totality of the circumstances and deal with the cases based upon the entire picture. I will form a domestic violence team that's equipped and trained to handle domestic violence cases so they could more effectively screen these cases and make a decision on how to proceed with domestic violence offenses.
Mr. Torres, how would your office approach determining whether to prosecute domestic violence cases?
Well, I think, you know, at the outset, there's no excuse for domestic violence. That it has such an incredible impact, not only on the victim, but oftentimes on children who grow up in those households. There is a new statistic that was released by a report to the Sentencing Commission that said that 100% of the juvenile detainees in the juvenile detention center had suffered at least some form of physical abuse or neglect. 100%. That's a reflection of the kind of damage that is wrought in the case of domestic violence. Now, I recognize that these are very difficult cases to bring. Oftentimes, we have witnesses or complaining witnesses who, you know, at a certain point no longer wish to cooperate. We need to do everything in our power to make sure that cases are screened accurately and with judgment, and that we support victims throughout the process. And provide services for those who can be rehabilitated, hopefully, to find counseling, to find new approaches, to bring these families together if possible, and if not, to make sure that people are safe and they feel safe in their homes and their children do as well.
Follow-up question, 45 seconds. Mr. Torres, what do you think about restorative justice programs? And would you consider advocating for these kinds of programs to be used in Bernalillo County as non-judicial resolutions to things like domestic violence, but not limited to domestic violence?
Right. No, I think restorative justice programs have shown a lot of promise around the country. I think we have to be careful to make sure that the implementation of specific programs is backed up by some evidence of their success, either in another jurisdiction or in another community, so that we know what we're getting into when we adopt an alternative method that's outside of the judicial process. But I think absolutely we have to be willing to break the mold. We are not succeeding in the criminal justice system, and we have to be willing to basically accept all of the things that aren't working and have our minds and our hearts open to new ideas, and I think that's an important one.
Mr. Perea, same question, 45 seconds. What do you think about restorative justice programs, and would you advocate for trying those out here in Bernalillo County?
Absolutely. Restorative justice, actually, it is an emerging trend, and we actually have it here in Bernalillo County, but it allows the victim to feel that they're part of the process. As it stands now, if a person is victimized, it goes into the system, and the system decides on the punishment, and the system decides what's going to happen with that case, and we're leaving out the victim. And what restorative justice does, it includes the victim in the healing process, because our system shouldn't only be about punishment. It should be about healing. It should be about making the victim feel whole again. So I've worked around some restorative justice programs, and I know it's effective, and I would be an advocate of restorative justice in our community.
New question, 90 seconds. Mr. Perea, sexual assault cases can be very difficult to prosecute for a bunch of reasons. How would you address this as district attorney?
And it goes back to the big picture, the reorganization of the office. I'll have core general trial teams, but I will have specialized trial teams. And one of those trial teams will deal with special victims unit or special victims such as violent crimes victims, sexual assault victims. And I will have trained prosecutors who have advanced training who deal specifically with these types of cases. They will be given the tools to do their job. I've handled and I've sat with victims of sexual assault, and I've held their hand and saw the tears in their eyes. And we can't allow for the system to re-victimize these victims yet again. We need to ensure that we're dealing with these sexual assault victims as effectively as possible. And we need to make sure that we're screening these out and trying to identify if we're not able to take a case to trial or to indictment. Why are we not able to? Is it a problem with the system? And we need to identify that. If it's a problem with the system, we need to fix it, because we need to ensure victims' rights. And we, as a criminal justice system, are doing our part.
Follow-up question, 45 seconds. Did I go to you yet? Sorry. Same question, 90 seconds. Sexual assault cases can be difficult to prosecute, getting ahead of myself, right? For a bunch of different reasons, mm-hmm. How would you address this as district attorney, Mr. Torres?
Well, you know, the first thing I would point out that it's, you know, it is absolutely unconscionable that you have over 5,000 untested rape kits in this state and nearly 3,000 rape kits sitting in Bernalillo County that haven't been tested. That is inexcusable. Again, in a country that spends $90 billion a year incarcerating people, we can't find the money to test those kits. Every one of those kits is someone's mother, someone's sister, someone's child. And if they have gone through the horrific process of having that kit obtained and they want and expect it to be processed, they have every right and expectation that that be done. And we have failed them as a community by turning a blind eye and failing to prioritize that. And it's just not acceptable that we don't have enough forensic examiners or we don't have enough personnel. We wouldn't accept this for anyone else. As my wife says, if this were happening to men at the rate that it happens to women, you wouldn't have a backlog like this. And I think there may be something to that. So I view this very seriously, and sexual assault cases will be a top priority, will be a part of what I envision as a major crime section. Because, again, the scar and the impact of that kind of assault lasts forever. It impacts a woman's life forever, her ability to deal with others, and you know, that's something that we have to take fundamentally seriously.
New question, 90 seconds. Mr. Torres, how would you decide whether to try young defendants as juveniles or adults? What kinds of considerations do you think are necessary for making that kind of decision? Age, mental capacity?
Well, I think, again, you have to look at all of the factors that go into a specific case. You have to look at their age. You have to look at a history of abuse. You have to look at their psychological condition. You have to look at a history of violence. You have to look at the specific circumstances of a case and make an individualized determination. I know that people oftentimes want sweeping checklists about, you know, when and how you're going to make a determination, but that isn't what the justice system is all about. It's about individual determinations, and that is never more important or apparent than in the case of juvenile offenders. And, you know, we're going to obviously follow the statute. There's a clear recognition about whether or not someone can be rehabilitated. But we need to look at all the factors that are involved in that kind of a case and consider also whether or not we think someone's going to pose a threat to the community in the future. And that's how we're going to move forward with juvenile defendants.
Mr. Perea, how would you decide whether to try young defendants as juveniles or adults? What are the considerations that you think are necessary there?
This is an issue that's close to my heart. As a parent, as a former school detective, as an educator, as a teacher in public schools, as a supervisor of the gang unit, as a high school coach, as an adjunct instructor on juvenile justice and juvenile law and procedure, I know the facts associated with juvenile crime. And we have our priorities that are topsy-turvy. We need to ensure that this is the opportunity to help young adults. This is the opportunity to treat young adults at their earliest stages. We need to take advantage of this opportunity. Because if we wait too long, we may have lost that opportunity. They may become part of this revolving door of the criminal justice system. When it comes to juvenile crimes, what that smacks us in the face of is an opportunity as a system and as a community. We need to ensure that we have effective diversion programs. And we have many programs out there that are currently in effect. We need to work closer with our behavioral health community so that we don't label a young child. Once a child is labeled, sometimes it's difficult for them to get off the track. Let's help them so they don't become part of the revolving door of our criminal justice system.
Thank you. We're going to talk a little bit about some specifics about the DA office and how it functions. The 2nd Judicial District is the busiest in the state of New Mexico. Some of the folks who submitted questions for this forum say that the DA's current mandatory plea policies mean that assistant district attorneys have little to no discretion in the cases that they work. They also said that many ADAs rarely get to handle cases from start to finish, and that many believe they are underpaid and overworked. Mr. Perea, how much discretion will you give to ADAs so that the resources of the office are used effectively and efficiently?
The criminal justice system nationwide pleads out about 95% of cases. It's a part of the system. The 2nd Judicial District pleads out a little higher, a few more cases than that, a little above the national average. We need to ensure that we hire qualified and competent prosecutors, and we need to ensure that we're training prosecutors and giving prosecutors the tools to do their job. And with that, we give them some autonomy. Give them some discretion to make sure that they have tools at their disposal to make the decisions that serves in the best interest of public safety. I believe that we need to give prosecutors some discretion. Clearly, you want to have some guidelines, because you don't want the case where you have one shoplifter being diverted to a shoplifting program, and you have another shoplifter getting 30 days in jail because you aggressively prosecute the shoplifter. There has to be some discretion, but there also has to be guidelines to ensure consistency and fairness.
Mr. Torres, how much discretion would you give ADAs so that the resources of the office were used effectively and efficiently?
I think frontline prosecutors need to have a considerable amount of discretion. Listen, we hire folks and hopefully give them the right kind of training to be professionals, to exercise professional judgment and exercise and utilize everything that they've learned. So we have to start treating people like professionals and let them resolve cases as early as we possibly can to relieve the strain on the system. But one of the key components that I think we're missing is a lack of training. When I was a young prosecutor, I was essentially handed a stack of files, and they pointed to the courthouse and said, "Don't screw up." That doesn't work. We need to have an extensive training program for people, where people get recurring training, and once they have that, once they have the resources in place and their guidelines are made clear, we need to be able to rely on them to exercise their judgment. That's the only way this system's going to work. The other thing that I want to point out is if we do away with an organization of the office around the types of crimes and we organize the office around the severity of the offender, we can actually provide some vertical integration so that the same prosecutor can handle the same defendant every time they come in and out. There's a familiarity there and an understanding of what the level of danger that's presented by that particular prosecutor, and I think that has real promise.
Follow-up question, 45 seconds. Mr. Torres, will you preserve existing divisions and sections within the office, an example being the grand jury section of the DA's office, and it's bouncing off of the things that both of you have mentioned, mm-hmm. and continue to have cases passed between divisions rather than having ADAs handle cases from start to finish? Explain how you're thinking of restructuring.
Right. So one of the things that they've recognized in cities and communities around the country that have really modernized their criminal justice system is that if you use an approach that orients the office around the severity of the offender with a major crimes division at the top and general trial divisions underneath, what that allows you to do is to organize the entire organization around the most serious offenders, because we have to eliminate the idea that folks are coming in different points of entry based on the type of crime that they've committed. And this is working in New York, this is working in San Francisco, this is working in big communities that have a much bigger caseload than we have. And I know that's a big change for people, but we have to, again, be willing to change to protect this community.
Mr. Perea, will you preserve existing divisions and continue to have cases passed from division section, rather than having ADAs handle cases from start to finish? Why or why not?
Efficiency requires innovation. And my model and my plan is to completely reorganize the office. Of course, we're going to take a look at what's working and what's not working. We're going to take a look and do a reorganization where we will establish generalist teams, trial teams, who will be assigned to a judge's courtroom. And they will handle all the cases in that judge's courtroom. And we'll have about 12 of those teams with about 5 or 6 prosecutors. We have about 110 prosecutors. Then we'll have a special victims teams, trial teams, that handle special cases like violent crime, like sex crimes, like DWI, and those types of offenses, so that we could give the attention to those cases that need the most attention. What, in my experience, my 3 decades of experience being in the courtroom in a variety of capacities, I realize we're losing a lot of cases because prosecutors are in too many courtrooms at the same time. And sometimes it delays the case, or we lose the case for a variety of reasons. This reorganization and this creation of trial teams will prevent that from happening. It's innovative, but after much discussion with career prosecutors, it's something that will work for the Second Judicial District.
Thank you, Mr. Pedea. I'm not sure that I understand whether you would allow ADAs to work cases all the way through or not with the structures that you're both describing. Mr. Torres?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. How many of those ADAs are going to be able to do that? Or is it based on their experience and their knowledge of particular cases, Mr. Torres? Talk a little bit more about how you would determine who gets to work cases vertically, as is the lingo I learned. Talk a little bit more about how you would determine that, and I'd also like to hear how you would structure the different ADAs based on their experience level. How do you envision that working?
Sure. So I think that the top priority, obviously, is to deal with the most violent and the most dangerous offenders. Sexual assault, violent crime, gun crime, obviously homicide, things like that all would work and flow through the Major Crimes Division. And everyone in that division would be a senior-level prosecutor, would have significant experience handling those kinds of cases. And every time one of their defendant appears back in the system, it doesn't matter if it's going to be a residential burglary or a low-end case, they get the same senior prosecutor. And the reason for that is that we want people that have an intimate knowledge of the seriousness and danger presented by that offender to be present, even if they come in on a low-level offense, because that's where you can have an outsized impact on the overall rate of crime. Because you have a very small percentage of the criminal population that drives an outsized percentage of total crime, the really violent crime. The problem is if they have multiple points of entry and a different DA assigned depending on, well, this is the narcotics division, or this is community, this is a violent crime case. We have multiple people assigned, and we don't have someone who is responsible for that individual. You wouldn't expect that in the healthcare system, that every time you came into the healthcare system, you'd see a different doctor every time you go. We need to be more detailed and more focused in the criminal justice system as well.
So the same question to you, Mr. Pedea, and I'm going to try to recreate it because I winged it a little bit. But talking about this new structure, how that would work for particular ADAs to work cases from beginning to end, and how you would address differing experience levels among the ADAs.
The innovation of these trial teams that we will create addresses just that. What we will have are teams of prosecutors, from junior prosecutors, relatively new prosecutors, to senior prosecutors. What that'll do is that'll allow the more or less experienced prosecutors to learn from the more experienced prosecutors, and it'll give the young prosecutors the opportunity to develop as a prosecutor. It'll keep the teams, it's a teamwork approach. They'll be able to interact and engage and learn from each other. The prosecutors with this team prosecution approach will handle a case from the very beginning, including portions of screening the case, taking the case to the grand jury, arraigning the case, and see that case all the way through. I think that's important to the development of prosecutors as well. We have a huge turnover rate in the Second Judicial District with prosecutors. Many of them are coming in, they're spending a couple years there, and they're leaving. Why are they leaving? We want to give prosecutors reasons to stay. We want to show young prosecutors that you have a future as a career prosecutor. And this development of prosecutors, this training of prosecutors, this mentoring of prosecutors will inspire those young prosecutors to stay, and greater and more effective prosecutions will be attained for Bernalillo County in the Second Judicial District.
Follow-up question, 45 seconds. Mr. Pedea, how exactly are you going to keep experienced ADAs and stop this turnover that you've described? What specifically are you going to do? Benefits? What's the magic? Explain.
Deja vu all over again? Okay, right. What we'll do is we'll create career paths. It's going to take leadership to inspire these young prosecutors, because prosecutors really don't make a lot of money. And they have to have reasons for staying. They have to have purpose. And so one of the things I will do is I will work hard to ensure that we have incentives. And some of those incentives will be to show the prosecutors that their roles and their job matters, that being a prosecutor is something in this county that you aspire to, and you aspire to stay there for 20 years. In law enforcement, I spent nearly a quarter of a century with one agency, the Albuquerque Police Department. I was inspired by the work that I was doing. I'd like to inspire young prosecutors to do the same. There aren't many prosecutors in the 2nd Judicial District who are retiring every year. I'd like to see a group retiring every year
who've decided to spend
a career prosecuting cases.
Mr. Torres, how would you address high turnover and subsequent loss of institutional knowledge at the district attorney's office?
Well, I think one of the most obvious things is that most folks either they go into the public defender's office or prosecutor's office, we don't do it for the money. And we know going in that we're never going to get rich. But we're going to have, I think, a sense of purpose. And we're going to have an opportunity to develop into something that as professionals is pretty remarkable. In no other profession do you have the depth and range of trial experience that you get as a criminal attorney on the front lines of the criminal justice system. But we need to do more to sharpen those skills and to demonstrate to people that there is a way to move up within the institution. This has to be an elite organization. I think we have to restore confidence in what we do and give people a renewed sense of purpose.
Mr. Torres, will you work to bring your office into the 21st century by updating IT systems and implementing digital document procedures? How would you do something like this?
So one of the troubling things, and I think one of the underlying problems when we talk about the new case management order, is the inability right now to effectively manage the transfer of discovery from law enforcement agency to the DA's office, to the public defender's office in a seamless way, in a way that can be verified, in a way that complies with the rules. We have to do that. Bringing in new information systems, innovating and modernizing what we do is a critical component to making that office successful. And again, it demonstrates that this is not a static institution. It can't be. We have to be on the forefront of change.
Mr. Perea, will you work to bring your office into the 21st century, update IT systems, digital document procedures? How would you do this?
Clearly, it's important that we innovate. We must innovate. We're in the 21st century. Technology is rapidly changing. And with the caseload of the 2nd Judicial District, which is the busiest caseload, we need to rely on modern technology. We need to do more paperless. We need to do a lot more with computers so that we're not shifting papers back and forth, so we're not filing papers. We need a lot more of a paperless system. And I think that's one of the areas that we can really improve in the 2nd Judicial District, is we really amplify and modernize our paperless system.
Mr. Perea, should funding for the district attorney's office be increased? What would be your top three financial priorities?
Absolutely. It's important. Funding is important. And we know that money is tight and funding is tight for all agencies out there. But it's important that we have funding to hire the necessary number of prosecutors that we need in order to effectively do our job. It's so important so that cases don't slip through the cracks. So we don't feel like we have to plea bargain cases out because we just want to push them through the system. But as I talked earlier, too, about inspiring prosecutors to become career prosecutors, I want to work hard to ensure that we pay prosecutors a decent wage for the important work that they do. So I'll ask for more funding for additional prosecutors in order to have the staff that we need to prosecute the volume of cases. I'll ask for greater funding in order to pay prosecutors a fair wage, in order to keep prosecutors in the office. But I'll also ask for an increase in funding. Going back to the former question, is that we need to increase and improve upon our technology, because our technology will make us more efficient. And efficiency is what we need more of in the office in order to effectively prosecute cases.
Mr. Torres, should funding for the DA's office be increased? What would be your top three financial priorities?
Well, I think clearly the most obvious one is to pay prosecutors what they're worth, and to give them a better salary, a better starting point in life. You know, we got a lot of people who come into this office making $40,000, $42,000 a year, and they're carrying massive amounts of student debt. And they're doing what they can to try and serve their community and make a difference for other people. And, you know, when we go to Santa Fe, we hear time and again about we want new penalties. We want new, tougher sentences. We want all of these things. But we're not going to pay anybody any more money to do this difficult work. So the number one priority is to pay people a better wage so that we can recruit the very best. The second thing we need to invest in is training. Once we can pay people what they're worth, we need to train them constantly. I know that we used to go to the National Advocacy Center for constant trial training. I don't believe that that's still available for state prosecutors, but there are alternative sources of training around the country, and we need to constantly improve what we do. And, of course, the last piece is the implementation of a whole new IT infrastructure. You still have databases in different agencies and within that office that don't communicate with one another. If we're going to do a data-driven approach that's objective, that's analytical, and it's going to have an outsized impact on public safety, we've got to build that system and invest in it.
Follow-up question, 45 seconds. Mr. Torres, would you support ADAs forming a union?
A union?
A union.
You know, I don't think at this point that there's a need for a union because at this, you know, at this stage as professionals, we have a lot more alternatives in terms of what's available to us. I certainly think that for staff, it's probably appropriate for people to be organized. But at this point, I'm not sure that it's necessary. I think the important thing for us to do is to, again, bring new resources into the system and pay people what they're worth. These are, after all, professional people, and they need to be respected and they need to be paid for the work that they do.
Mr. Perea, would you support ADAs forming a union? 45 seconds.
We know that within the DA's office that there are many of the staff members are already part of a union. But as far as the ADAs are concerned, we have to go back and ask the question, why do people join unions to begin with? Often they join unions because they feel they need some form of protection. They need a voice at the bargaining table. But I think if you're treating prosecutors in a fair manner, and you're paying prosecutors what they're worth, and you're training prosecutors, and you're giving them what they need in order to effectively do their job, they'll feel that there's no need for a union. But I think we need to look at the issues and even talk to prosecutors, the prosecutor who brought up this question, why do you think a union is important to begin with? And let's address those problems. We might be able to do that without even bringing a union into the process.
Thank you, Mr. Perea. Let's talk a little bit about the district attorney's relationship with communities, victims, and witnesses. Mr. Perea, how will your office prioritize working with crime victims and witnesses, and specifically if you can talk about when their interests are not necessarily in line with the DA's interests in certain cases, when there's tension there?
The district attorney is a public servant. The district attorney answers to the people. The district attorney is charged with ensuring that justice is served and cases that need to be prosecuted are prosecuted. It's important that the district attorney listens to the people and hears the voice of the people. The district attorney should be the busiest person in the criminal justice system. The district attorney should be out at the vast majority of community meetings, should be part of the Chamber of Commerce. It's so critical to understanding the needs of the community is to listen to the people. It's a critically important role. Under this concept of community policing, which is involved into this office as community prosecutions, it's about creating partnerships. And if we create partnerships and we work with all stakeholders, we're much stronger for it. So yes, the DA must ensure that she is the catalyst for change. And that requires listening to all stakeholders.
Mr. Torres, how will your office prioritize working with crime victims and witnesses, specifically when the office's interests are not perfectly in line with what those individuals' interests might be.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, the interests of victims are paramount in the criminal justice system. And one of the things that I talk about repeatedly in the community is, given my experience, what I've seen is that no matter the outcome, a lot of times victims and victims' families are waiting for a resolution in the criminal justice system that never comes. And we need to understand that no matter what happens, they're going to be living with the consequences of what they've endured for the rest of their lives. So we have to respect that. I think that's particularly true when it comes to drunk driving, when it comes to sexual assault, when it comes to violent crime. We have to make sure that victims feel welcome in the DA's office. You asked a question earlier about the role that MAD should play. I would like MAD to come into the DA's office and give me repeated reports on our performance and what we can do better to bring those kinds of cases and make sure that we are listening to victims. Now, we can never abdicate our role as representatives of the state of New Mexico, and at the end of the day, if we have to make a decision based on the law and based on the facts, then that's what we have to do. But we have to communicate that always with victims and recognize that they have more at stake in this than basically anyone else.
Last question. Second to last question, I think. 90 seconds, Mr. Torres. If you are elected, do you plan to do community outreach, and what would that look like?
So one of the things that I think we need to establish is community prosecution. You hear a lot about community policing, but very little about community prosecution. And I've gone around to neighborhood associations around the community, and I very rarely encounter anyone from the district attorney's office. We have to understand that crime unfolds in distinct parts of this community. Every neighborhood in Bernalillo County has its own patterns of crime. But we are not doing justice if what we do in that office is disconnected from what's happening on the ground. We need to go out and engage with community leaders and faith-based organizations, people who understand what is the most pressing concern in their neighborhood, and be a part of the process. Tell us, you know, in your neighborhood, identify the top three things that you're most concerned about from a criminal justice standpoint, and then take the data from our office and say, are the cases that we're prosecuting, do they actually match the priorities that you and the neighborhood have identified? That's the kind of dynamic response that we need that goes hand in hand with a data-driven approach. Again, we need to make sure that we enlist the entire community. Every neighborhood, every leader, every family member, every person in this community has a role to play and has a stake in bringing about public safety. We can't do this alone, and we have to enlist the support of every community leader.
Mr. Perea, if you are elected, do you plan to do community outreach, and what would that look like?
I come from, my experience and background is from a community-oriented policing model. I was one of the pioneers of community-oriented policing, bringing community policing to Albuquerque. And I know all the principles associated with community policing. Key principles, of course, are creating partnerships, so you engage in the ongoing interaction. It's so important that we have an open door. However, who's going to be responsible for reaching out to the community? I want my prosecutors in the courtroom. That's where I want my prosecutors. I will be in the community, listening to the community, and maybe some of my chiefs will be doing the same thing, because I think that's where we need to ensure that all the offices involved, and with the feedback that we get from the community, the leaders within my office, we'll go back and implement policies that might apply to the feedback that they've been given. It's very, very important to ensure that as we engage, and we will engage, closer with all stakeholder groups, that we do so effectively. But I want my prosecutors to prosecute cases and my leaders to ensure that they're working closely with the community in order to get positive or critical feedback in order to address any policies where a gap might exist.
Follow-up question, how will you demonstrate to Bernalillo County and the community that you are an ethical person who believes in government, good government, transparency, and ethical practice as elected officials, Mr. Padilla?
What we've done is who we are. Everything else is just talk. I've spent 3 decades serving the citizens of Albuquerque as a police officer, as a police commanding officer, as an educator, and as a prosecutor. And I realize that reputation is everything. Reputation is everything. The DA serves as the role model, and the DA should serve as the role model for the entire criminal justice system. Because in this case, in today's environment, the DA is the catalyst for change. And the DA must have the stature, the background, and the experience to lead the way. And integrity and ethics is on top of that list. So it's very important that the DA serve as that role model to the community and to the criminal justice system.
Thank you, Mr. Perea. Mr. Torres, if you are elected, how will you demonstrate that you are an ethical person and that you believe in good government and transparency and behaving ethically as a professional?
Well, one of the things I think we need to do is be as transparent as we can about the decisions that we make. This is particularly true with, again, officer-involved shootings or allegations of misconduct. We need to be willing to do those in an open forum, in a preliminary hearing, and not in a closed proceeding in a grand jury. I think that would go a long way to showing people how we make our decisions, what we do with the evidence, and when, you know, what we're committed to. The second thing is we need to be open to feedback from the community, and if there is any indication that something has been done incorrectly in the courtroom or that there are claims of actual innocence, the district attorney's office needs to be open to receiving that information, and someone should be tasked with that so that we can review cases and make sure that we get it right, because that's important.
The candidates will now have 2 minutes to give a closing statement. I believe we started with you, Mr. Torres, so we'll start with you, Mr. Perea, for the closing statement. 2 minutes.
Thank you all for coming out. I think it's important to come and listen and be part of this process. You all are part of the process. And you probably all have different roles in our community. But again, I thank you for taking time out of your busy evening. As I mentioned, I spent three decades in our community. I'm part of this community. I'm part of the fabric of this community. I'm a crime fighter. I'm an educator, and I'm a prosecutor. But more importantly, I'm a son, and I'm a parent. And this community is important to me. I've dedicated my life to this community. I've been involved in this community in every way possible. I was born and raised and educated in this community. My undergraduate degree is from UNM. My law degree is from UNM. This community is important to me. But I realize, based upon 3 decades of experience and involvement in this community, that we are a community in crisis. Property crimes are up. Violent crimes are up. We no longer trust some of our criminal justice agencies like we should. I envision a community where we hold people accountable, especially those that maintain the public trust. Corruption by government officials will not be tolerated. We need to protect our citizens, and we need to slam shut the revolving door of the criminal justice system. We need to be transparent. We need to be open, and we need to be honest. But there's no magic bullet. We just can't talk. What it requires is action. And that action requires leadership. I'm the only district attorney candidate that has decades of supervision, management, and leadership experience, who has worked all aspects of the criminal justice system, from the initial report taking to submission of the investigation to the prosecution of cases. It's about leadership, and leadership will be what moves Bernalillo County forward, making Bernalillo County a safer community for all of us.
Thank you, Mr. Perea. 2 minutes, Mr. Torres.
So I want to thank everyone for being a part of this discussion. I think the choice in this election is relatively clear. This is about whether or not we are prepared to move into the future, or whether we are going to rely on the same failed policies and ideas of the past. One of the things that we have done over the last 3 or 4 decades in this country is every time that there is a crisis in the criminal justice system, We always rush to say and stand before the community and say, we have to be tough. We have to be tough. It's time to lock everyone up. And if only we lock everyone up and throw away the key, you'll live in a safer community. Well, guess what? We incarcerate more people in this country than any other nation on the planet. We account for 5% of the world's population and 25% of the world's inmates. And you're not safer for it. It's not enough to be tough. Now, I get it. I've been on the front lines. I've handled murder cases and sexual assault cases and child abuse cases. I can be tough. But that doesn't mean we can't also be smart. We have to change what we are doing. It is time for reform. There is an awakening in this community. There's an awakening in this country that what we are doing and the path we are on simply isn't working. So what does that mean? It means employing modern technology and modern strategies to use every tool at our disposal to organize and prioritize the most violent and dangerous offenders. It means integrating that approach with every part of the community and every part of every neighborhood so that we have the feedback of the people that we serve. More than anything, you have to recognize that we're not going to imprison our way to a safer community. People that have chronic addiction, people that have mental health issues, we have to find a better way. It's time to embrace the future and not the past. It's time to build a criminal justice system that not only makes us safe, but one that makes us proud. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Torres. Thank you both for your thoughts on these important issues. Good luck to you both on June 7th. You're competing in the Democratic primary. I hope that whichever one of you prevails in the primary will return to this stage along with Simon Kubiak to continue this conversation as we approach the general election in November. Yes? Tell me yes, Simon.
Of course.
Fantastic. Yes?
Yes.
Fantastic. We will post links to the video and audio of this conversation on KUNM.org so that you can share it with folks who couldn't be here today or tune in live. Republican candidate for district attorney.
Thanks.
We'll also broadcast a slightly shortened version of this conversation at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning on KUNM. Thanks again to the criminal law section of the New Mexico State Bar for planting the seed for this event and partnering with KUNM to make it happen. Thanks to KUNM's Marisa DeMarco and Anna Landy for your assistance. Thanks to the video people. They're the folks who made the tech possible here at the State Bar Center Auditorium, and to production staff at KUNM who helped us on that end of the audio and video stream. Thanks to everyone who showed up today, and that will be our program.
Thank you. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.